You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
So welcome to another episode. Today, I'm here with Gabriela Henault, who is the Chief Marketing Officer of Alpha Sites. And we're going to be talking today to someone who's gone through an increasingly common situation, which is a sort of transition from the consulting side, from the advisory side to the client side, a journey that we see more and more people embarking on and get under the hood in that. So Gabriela, thanks for joining us and welcome.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
And where are you joining us from today?
I'm actually in Paris today.
That is wonderful. And for the people that are listening, I probably wish that they were there as well. So maybe let's jump straight in. Talk to us. Let's just start with the fact that you're at Alpha Sites today. Probably a lot of people haven't heard of Alpha Sites. Tell us a bit about the company, the industry, who you serve.
Yeah, absolutely. So Alpha Sites is a medium-sized business, about 2,000 employees. We started in 2008 by two co-founders who still run the business today. And the best way to describe us is a knowledge on demand platform. And essentially what we do is we provide professional investors with access to individuals who are experts in an industry, geography, or company. And they then speak to those experts and in order to gather information, get smarter. And so it's kind of, we're basically in a subdomain of primary research. And one of the really interesting things about the way Alpha Sites has approached the industry is that about 6 years ago, Alpha Sites started to really heavily invest in technology. So they took what was originally created as a sort of professional services industry and have transformed into a tech-enabled company over the last 6 years. And so that's been just an incredible journey and fascinating to watch and be a part of.
So if I'm in management consultancy or if I'm a private equity and I'm looking to make an investment or I'm serving a specific client and I need that quick hit expert insight, then Alpha Sites helps pair me with someone who could then really speed up or accelerate my knowledge on a specific topic. Is that roughly the proposition?
Yep. That's exactly right. Yeah. It helps accelerate your knowledge, help to deepen your knowledge, because in our clients' industries and in consulting for people who work in funds, hedge funds, private equity funds, they're always trying to move faster than the competition. A lot of funds are chasing the same deals. And then they're also always trying to find a unique angle. So it's about the speed of access to information, but it's also about the depth of information and just becoming an expert really quickly so that you can find the best angle over your competitors. So it's really cool because we're actually in the business of helping to really utilize the tacit knowledge that is stuck in people's brains all over the world and to kind of democratize the sharing of it.
Not fully democratized because you only want a few people to have it because otherwise they don't get the edge.
That's true. But we want to make sure that anybody who wants to access it can. And actually, we often do find that a lot of our, what's really interesting is you start to see sort of what's the level of rigor and diligence that different companies put into their knowledge discovery work. So we'll be able to observe those kind of research patterns and how they change, right? And how one consultancy may talk to three experts, right? Tiny end size. Another consultancy who from the outside looks like they're probably working on the same deal because they want to speak to people with really similar profiles. Maybe they'll have an end size, which is like five times, right? So you also start to notice really interesting things like that about how the patterns of how different companies work, different people work, how knowledge flows go. In other words, in which part of the world do the experts sit and in which part of the world do the knowledge seekers sit, right? So it's very cool that way from a sort of macro trend observation perspective.
And I bet if you could even listen into conversations with the same expert, you'd even probably get to see a difference in how they ask the questions, the type of questions they ask as well.
Yeah, I'm sure you would. Now, we obviously can't listen into their conversations, but their compliance officers can. And yes, I think you would definitely see a difference. And you know this as an interviewer, right? You need to know how to ask the right questions in order to get good information. So, and the quality of the interviewers probably does vary from one client to another.
It's interesting because a friend of mine is a CFO of a healthcare company, and it's something that he has done an increasing amount over the last 2 years. It feels like every week he's like, oh yeah, I had to do this paid interview where I acted as a subject matter expert for something or other. It feels like it, not only is it it feels like a growing trend, but B, you mentioned that technology is a big differentiator. Mm-hmm. How does that actually help then? As opposed to, well, look, we've got a really good group of, you've got a huge network of connections. So whatever question you have, we can go and find the right expert. But how does technology become a differentiator? How do you distinguish yourself in the space?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So different players in the space use technology in different ways. A lot of our competitors use technology to essentially identify experts and create a massive database of experts who they can tap into. Having said that, because the experts are identified often using AI and sort of crawlers and things like that, they're not necessarily pre-vetted. So it's kind of the equivalent of you or me going into LinkedIn and typing, and we have access to lots of names, but the filtering is maybe it hasn't been done by a human. But that's a use of technology, which is incredibly powerful in this industry. The way AlphaSites is using technology is that we actually have a smart human vet every single expert, and we only recruit experts for people's projects. So the quality of the experts that we recruit is higher because they're each handpicked for existing client briefs, existing client projects. But we then use technology to codify or structure a lot of data about that expert's knowledge areas on the back end. So we then store that, and then it's much easier for the client to then access that structured data, or their colleagues, or future individuals who want to refer that expert. So essentially, we're able to act as kind of like the brain of a large organization. So if you think about like a huge management consultancy, right, they're doing globally thousands and thousands of these calls a year. And for them to keep track of all of that knowledge and not let it go to waste, it's incredibly hard because they have these calls happening in different geographies, different languages, different employees. Maybe those employees are storing them on their hard drive and leaving, you know, all of this. Whereas we can then store all that information and we can structure it so that then if individuals from that consultancy want to say, oh, let me go through the transcripts of those calls and see what I can find about XYZ company through keyword searches, all that information can get structured and they can refer back to it. It's their information, right? They paid for the access to that expert and they should have be able to refer back to it. So that's an example of one of the ways that AlphaSites is doing things differently. And I think in a very innovative way, it's really all about structured data.
It's interesting there because when you having, we're going to get to this in a second, but having been in consultancy for so long, one of the questions you often ask is, you know, what business are we in or what business are you in? And oftentimes consultants get hired when the client says, well, if you ask 10 people, you get 10 different answers. And I've heard from you say, well, you could say that you're in the knowledge management business, so you're in the structured data business. How do you describe then what business you're in? Especially like there are so many parallels to what you're saying that almost sound very similar to what a modern talent or recruitment agency has in terms of some of the core skill sets.
Yeah. I mean, I thought a lot about that because one of the first things I did when I joined AlphaSites in 2020 was to do a sort of brand repositioning, both from a visual identity refresh. And the reason for that was because we were ready to go to market with this much more tech-enabled solution. And we needed to figure out how to signal the change. And so actually what we landed on is all the individuals who worked on the project together was to describe ourselves as a knowledge on-demand platform. Because that really describes, I think, the benefit to the end consumer or the end user, right? It's accessing the knowledge of experts on demand through a digital platform. Now, all the other things that we've talked about, right? Structured data, et cetera, those are the enablers, right? Those are the means to the end, the bits of IP that we've created, which enable us to provide on-demand access to this tacit knowledge.
Okay, so that's a great segue then into the fact that you came into this mm-hmm. role a couple of years ago. Let's go back a couple of steps and talk about then, to tell us about your journey in consulting and advisory and what sort of led to that moment where you're like, I'm ready to make the jump, ready to leap.
Yeah. Well, I started actually in advertising. I worked very briefly at AMV BBDO, which is a great London-based ad agency. And then I moved to the brand consultancy arm of BBDO and spent about 2 years there and kind of learned consulting, learned business. I had studied political sciences at university, so I had a lot of basics about business to learn. And then once I had sort of gotten those under my belt, then I went to Profit Brand Strategy, where I spent 14 years. And I really, really sort of grew up there professionally. Absolutely loved it. I joined when it was 100 people. Michael Dunn, the CEO, interviewed me. He was interviewing everyone at the time. You know, I traveled a lot, formed really strong bonds with my colleagues, with my clients. Tons of variety in the work, just had the most amazing time. And after 14 years of that, though, I thought, okay, well, I kind of want to become a little bit more well-rounded as a marketer. I've been doing a ton of strategy. Yeah, design strategy, digital strategy, brand strategy, but so much strategy work. I kind of want to see what it's like to be an operational marketer. And so that's when I started to look around and I found AlphaSights, which is a great business. It's a business that I knew a little bit about. I had used the service before as a consultant, founder-led business, still at a good size. I think it was about just around 1,000 people when I joined, maybe 900. So not too big, not a sort of Fortune 500 type atmosphere. And I just sort of took the leap. I thought they're willing to take a chance on me and I understand the business and I'm passionate about it. And I know they need to do a brand repositioning, so at least I'm sure I can help with that bit and the rest we'll see. So to your other part of the question, was I ready? No, probably not ready, but I think one never is ready for these changes. You just have to go in, and I had the confidence to know that at least one of the things in my mandate I was going to be able to do really well. So I think that's probably what gave me the courage to say, okay, let's try.
That's a really interesting insight, because embedded in that story were a few of those criteria, like you said, that, okay, if you're going to do it to set yourself up for success, it sounds like the biggest thing was great. The initial ask, there's clarity around, it's not like you went in to look at the first 60, 90 days and then decide that a brand positioning needed to be done. Like that was already sort of agreed and aligned on at a senior level inside you, because we all know that sometimes that alignment inside a company takes, so sometimes it takes 3 years from CMO or the brand lead knowing that a reposition needs to be done and it actually starting, because brand is one of those things that needs so much alignment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think because they knew they wanted to do a brand repositioning, that's why my profile was attractive over a marketer with very complete experience, but perhaps less brand focused than I had been in the past. And you're absolutely right. I think it's very helpful to walk into a mandate knowing at least one of the jobs to be done, because when you're new to an organization, it takes a little while to figure out what should be on that roadmap. Everybody's going to give you a different list of priorities. Everybody's going to tell you that a different thing is broken. And sorting through all that information and really understanding the business well enough to prioritize properly, that can take a little time. And I remember when I was at Profit, one of the things we'd help a lot of CMOs with, their sort of first 90 or 100 day plan. And it's really hard to create one because you need to learn the industry and the organization so fast, and you have to figure out how to prioritize it. That's no small feat. So I think I was very fortunate to have at least one big project earmarked for me, so I could go in, sink my teeth in, get a win on the scoreboard early.
So compare and contrast then the experience of having gone through dozens of brand repositioning, brand evolution exercises on the consulting side, and then having gone through your first one then client side.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So first insight was that when I was client side, there wasn't nearly as much appetite or patience to do the strategy part as rigorously as we usually would have done it at Profit for our big Fortune 500 clients, right? So trying to find that happy medium between knowing that it was really important to apply a certain amount of rigor, knowing it was important to test and learn, but not going overboard and also not giving up and doing none of it at all, trying to find that happy medium was a little bit challenging, I'd say. But that was probably the first thing that surprised me. When you walk in there and you say, what, you mean you don't want us to do focus groups, then quant research, and then focus groups again? And they're like, no, that sounds like it's going to take 9 months. We definitely don't want to do that. That was probably the first surprise, the first thing that was different. And then it was also, I must say, I loved working with the in-house design team to create the visual identity and giving them the chance to create it and then implement it. That I absolutely love doing. And I think it was so much more rewarding for them. And I think the implementation of the visual identity went much more smoothly as a result. That was also very different because obviously when I'd been on the advisory side, we have, you know, brilliant teams of graphic designers coming up with something spectacular. And then the design team at the client side sort of starts to groan when they think about how to implement it and the, all the impracticalities and, oh, you've just put an ombre color into my color palette. How am I going to put that into my email signature? And so, whereas it was really great to have the same team that working on the visual identity and the implementation. And that is something which I think was also like far more time and cost efficient, to be honest with you. And that was a big learning for me that I would definitely try to take on for the future.
It sounds like some of the learnings or some of the differences were less about the fact that you were working client side versus internally. And part of it was because maybe a medium-sized company like Alpha Sites wouldn't really have had the budget with a profit where you applied this. It's also, it indicates a little bit from an advisory side that you need to flex the process and the approach depending on the client. I feel like 10 years ago, it was very much a one-note approach to how you did a brand evolution project. Like you said, okay, it's going to be these steps. It's always the same step. It's going to take 6 to 9 months. But now it feels like you need to be thinking about these types of brand projects in a more heterogeneous way, as opposed to it just being very homogenous.
Yeah, absolutely. I think anyone working in marketing now needs to keep questioning, has to constantly ask themselves, what's the right process? Just because I followed that process before, it doesn't mean it's the right one for this organization at this moment in time. And I would kind of challenge what you just said. I think you're right. Historically, a lot of the large companies have been really up for these lengthy, rigorous processes. And that's what I experienced as well. But I think that times are changing. And I think that also a lot of these very large companies are saying, we're going to take a more agile approach. We're going to be a little braver. We're going to do things differently. And it's really important to, I think, as you said, be super adaptable and try it different ways. The other thing which I remember from my advisory days is that people often hire consultants or agencies because they want really good creative ideas or really good structured strategy or incredible rigor, right? Really deep analysis, right? Those are some very common reasons. And once you're client side, I think you know what's going to drive the smooth decision-making process quite well. That's your job to understand that. And so it then helps you better decide, okay, do I actually need an agency or not? Or you know what? I actually just need creativity, but I don't need rigor and I don't need anyone to help me with stakeholder management. So maybe I'm fine with just some freelancers who are going to inject some additional creative firepower into my process. So that was another big learning for me once I went client side to sort of take that structure, which I was aware of and I was familiar with, and realize how actually, depending on what you need, an agency can be the perfect solution, but sometimes it's overkill. And actually, there are other ways to get that rigor or the strategy or the creativity into the process.
I think, not to overdo the point here, but I think the other thing that you, that even your role demonstrates, is there's a lot more brand expertise inside organizations, inside client side, compared to 10 years ago. Like I said, there's been this big trend of a lot of people who done the brand work at an agency inside the client. So when you have that much higher level of expertise material, like I said, sometimes then you almost play that consultant role internally, that stakeholder management you mentioned.
Yeah.
Or you need an agency that's going to work in a much more collaborative way, as opposed to coming in and presenting at you, but instead you're working together. You're actually getting involved in the meat of the process, get involved in the workshops, in the co-creation, because you're going to have to live with it. And I think that's an aspect that's important for agencies to adapt to the maturity level and the expertise that exists within the client organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree. Yeah.
Okay. So beyond the brand repositioning, just more generally, because you come in as a CMO, not just to come and do brand, what are the skills that you felt you've been able to bring to the role that you've seen now in the time that you've been there that have made a difference that you feel that you acquired from consulting?
In consulting, I think you definitely learn how to structure and break down problems. And that was very valuable skill. You learn how to project and process manage, also hugely valuable. Stakeholder management, even on the people management side, I think a lot of my leadership style, the way I provide feedback, the type of feedback I provide, the sort of standards that I set, all of that was very much defined in my years as a consultant. So I think really the skills that I acquired are actually very broad. They're not just marketing skills, I'd say. I probably would have, if I'd left Profit and taken a role in the learning and development team at a large corporate, I probably would have utilized the exact same skills as the ones that I took and then translated into my role as CMO.
And let's look at the other side of that. And so what surprised you? What weren't you prepared for?
Yeah, so I think the thing that I absolutely was not prepared for, I feel so naive saying this out loud now, is that when you're on the advisory side, you know when you're going to have a conversation with a client, right? You have it in the diary. There's anticipation, there's buildup. You're physically leaving your building or you're getting on a Zoom call, right? And so you prep for it, right? And you prep your team for it. And I hadn't fully understood that once you're in-house, every conversation with any colleague is a client conversation. And not just the conversations you're having, but the conversations that the people in your team are having too. So every Slack, every email, every coffee chat, every formal meeting, they're all mini client interactions. And I had not really thought that part through. I had not totally understood that before actually making the move. And then, you know, you start to hear after a couple of weeks or months feedback through the channels of, oh, so-and-so in your team needs to learn more about XYZ topic. And you get little, you know, slivers of, you know, constructive feedback. And you think, well, that's odd. Where did this come from? And you start to investigate. And so that was probably the most abrupt change for me.
That's fascinating. Because so you're saying that every essentially informal conversation that you're not formally recording or thinking about as formal is either advancing the ball forward or it's neutral or potentially going backwards or it's yep. creating something else that you weren't even thinking about is coming. And it's not just yours, it's everyone on the team. So how do yep. you then balance out, especially because you've got other people on the team having these conversations, balance out the empowerment of the team with being able to maintain some aspect of control around the narrative or the message, or ensuring that you got people on the team who are prepared to be able to engage with those stakeholders, and you're not then afterwards then having to manage a fire because they explain something in a different way, or like you said, the constructive feedback that comes through the grapevine.
Yeah, it's really tough. I don't think I have it down to a science yet, but certainly I think just explaining that to the people on the team, giving them that insight so that they understand what's at stake and they understand why they have to sort of really show up suited and booted every day, ready to give 100%. They understand the stakes essentially. So I think that's the first thing that I've learned, that setting that expectation is already immensely helpful. And then the other thing that I try to do is basically not put people in a situation where they're leading any kind of formal meeting until they're about 2 years into the role. So they really have time to practice and to build their confidence and to watch other people present sort of officially responsible for a meeting. Now, in between then, of course, they'll be having coffee chats with people and they'll be responding to people's emails and Slacks and having all sorts of interactions, but essentially trying to layer on those responsibilities little by little and definitely not throwing them in at the deep end on day one. So those are some of the things. And then, of course, you know, we do presentation training and things like that for team members. I think probably of those three things, I think just giving them that awareness, explaining the importance of it is, in my experience, the thing that's worked the best.
How have you seen that intentionality that you've put in pay off? So if you compare now 18 months on from where things were, what are you seeing that's different to before?
Well, I see that the reputation of certain individuals in the team has really skyrocketed, right? They're perceived better and therefore the whole team is perceived better. I've also observed that they prepare differently for meetings. They'll prepare a lot more. They'll sync with colleagues more. They'll make sure that they really understand a topic. so that because they're more aware that at any given moment in time, someone could come to them with a question, and that actually they will look better and the entire team will look better if they can answer it, as opposed to having to say, oh, you know what? That's not really me. Now let me go ask my colleague and get back to you, right? So it spurred a lot more collaboration in the team, communication in the team, and a willingness. Yeah, I guess more intentionality and desire, passion to be able to understand a broader array of topics and answer questions about a broader array of topics versus before I really doubled down on this, people were kind of more siloed, right? They were like, no, I do demand generation, so I'm only going to be able to answer demand generation questions. I'm not really equipped to answer questions about the visual identity or as an example.
So when you came in, your first task was to do something that you had a lot of experience with doing, right? The repositioning. After that was finished, what happened next? Like, how did you start to think about, after that initial piece, how you were going to manage your perception? After the initial honeymoon was over, the excitement of bringing in someone who was on a consultant side to do the brand repositioning where they were in their element. But tell us about the next part of that journey.
Well, it was a little bit more chaotic than that because I came in, first of all, in January of 2020. And by March, everyone was in full lockdown. So full lockdown, two kids at home, the homeschooling, you know, all of that chaos. And my CMO remit, it covers internal comms, external comms, demand generation, and design and digital. So it's actually a bit broader. And so the brand positioning was in that structure. It would have fallen into external comms, but I was still having to run demand generation, internal comms, and a whole bunch of other things. So unfortunately, it wasn't as linear as perhaps would have liked because there was just so much to get done so quickly. So, for example, in parallel to doing the brand repositioning, I was trying to implement a lot more sort of structure and a lot more measurement in our demand generation sort of email marketing processes. And effectively what happened is that was running in parallel to the brand repositioning. So kind of being pulled in different directions. As soon as the brand repositioning was done, then it was, okay, now we update the website. Okay, now we update our EVP. Okay, now we redo all of our talent marketing collaterals, you know, so you had kind of like, that was one giant work stream. And as soon as one thing was done, there was another project on the horizon, sort of that was ticking along. But then you had three other work streams going on in different part areas of marketing. So it was a little bit chaotic, and at least it felt a little bit chaotic in that first year, particularly with, I think, COVID. It made it a little harder.
As I reflect on your answer, I think the premise of my question was ultimately flawed because I think I was asking the question through this lens of, well, that's how an advisor or consulting firm thinks about it, which is ideally you're going to go through this process. I don't know if that experience of yours, of where you had all these other demands that were happening parallel, is unique to Alpha or a big company or had anything to do with COVID. I think that's the reality client side, is that it's not like everything stops when the brand, doesn't matter how big the brand work is, all the other things still need to be going on there. And increasingly there are more and more responsibilities, like you said, especially when you have internal comms. I think the days even of the ideal brand process have sort of gone. You have to be more agile. It's like, oh, we're working on, how many times do I hear, oh, okay, we're going to start the whole brand process now, but we're going to launch the website in 3 months.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. And I suspect that it's like that in every other business and for every other CMO. And as you said, before I went client side, I just didn't necessarily realize that. And then once you're walking somebody else's shoes for a little while, do somebody else's job, then you have a little bit more appreciation for, okay, these people on the client side are juggling so many different balls, right? And that's another great reason why people hire consultancies and agencies. It's to give them that fantastic leverage so that they can keep so many projects afloat at the same time.
How do you sort of reflect on now being at a medium-sized company, how the role of brand is different at a medium company versus a large company where, you know, a larger organization, they can have a dedicated brand team that's at least focused on brand all the time, but in a smaller, more nimble team where you've got lots of different priorities, you can't, to your point, like be focused on the big brand strategy piece the whole time.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I don't know that I think about it exactly through the same lens as what you phrase, because what I hear you getting at is like a resource constraint, and that a resource constraint may stop individuals or teams from focusing on brand more. What I experience at AlphaSites is that actually we set the brand strategy, we defined it, we set the visual identity, we ran with both of those for about a year. Then we made some tweaks to the visual identity. And then we decided to just keep everything stable. Why? Because it was time to just implement and keep things constant and not confuse our audiences, right? And we needed to just repeat those messages over and over and over again. And the plan is quite literally to keep everything constant for probably the next 3 years, not because of lack of resources, but simply because we now know what we want to stand for to our different audiences. And we now just need to get them to really internalize those messages. And so repetition is key. And that's also because AlphaSites is a, yes, medium size, but also be sort of, you know, tech enabled. We're kind of like B2B because our clients are in management consulting and in hedge funds. And so we don't need to be running big brand campaigns, big ad campaigns, right? That's not relevant for our audiences. So there's no real business need to change the creative strategy every season or every year. So I think for that reason, brand in for this business really only has to get studied, analyzed to make sure it's relevant, to make sure it's getting cut through and it's representing the business every couple of years, right? But not in the same way that a big B2C brand would be doing. So that's sort of how I think about it. And just getting our message across, whether it's what we stand for as a company, what we stand for as an employer, or even at the value prop level of a particular service, what we're trying to do is just get a flywheel going, because we want people to come to our platform, to do a bunch of things on the platform, and that's where they're going to get upsell, cross-sell, that's where they're going to experience a whole bunch of other services, right? That's the point of our marketing strategy, right? To just get people into our digital environment. That's what we need to be focusing on. And we just need to be super clear and repeat over and over and over again in order to make that happen.
When you go back and meet some of your colleagues and friends from the advisory world, now that you're client side, are there any sort of observations that you make for them around things that when you reflect back in the consulting world that actually are different to the reality that when you're now client side? Like any myths that you sort of would dispel that are typical on the agency side?
Yeah, I think that as per what we discussed earlier, I think maybe my ex-colleagues, my friends who are still on the advisory side don't always appreciate how busy people are on the client side, how they're being pulled in many different directions. So I definitely tell them about that. And then also just how much work can often be required, you know, to manage the stakeholders on the client side, right? To get that alignment and how important it is for them to understand those power dynamics, right? And for them to help whoever hired them to not take on the feedback of the stakeholders who matter and to have updates and quick wins and things to share internally so they can show momentum, right? So I definitely share that back with my ex-colleagues, because when you're on the outside, I'm not sure everyone can necessarily intuitively see all that.
Well, yeah, but there's a tendency sometimes to talk about client issues in a pretty simplistic way, yeah. Right? And say, oh God, let me tell you about this client. Oh, they really struggle to make a decision. Well, they don't talk to each other or they can't get anything through.
Yeah, exactly. I think the question to ask is, instead of saying those things, it's more like, okay, why are they struggling to get things through? Let me think about that. Let me try to help my client navigate that, right? I think a good advisor should be doing those things. And it's not just about coming up with a great idea or a great marketing strategy. It's about helping your client to actually make it happen, right? To get it approved and to get it implemented. And often the implementation, you know, once your client side is you're implementing through individuals who are not on your team, who don't report into you, right? You need to get people in another organization, in recruiting and talent acquisition and in professional development, right? All these individuals who don't report into you in marketing, they need to help you to implement it so that it actually gets to the front line. And so a huge amount of collaboration is required in order to achieve that.
I think one of the really interesting takeaways from what you've said is this idea that a lot of times on the consulting advisory side, we see too much of our work being purely defined by the deliverable. It's the PowerPoint presentation. It's the visual identity. Whereas there needs to be more of a shift to be thinking about, no, the deliverable is advisory. Well, what does that mean? So advisory means actually understanding these dynamics, helping these dynamics, and judging the performance so much actually on the success of those aspects, other than just thinking about, great, did I deliver on the thing that was in the scope of work?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I couldn't agree with you more, because you have to remember that the person who hired you, they're only measured on impact, right? They're hired. Their whole purpose is to make things happen. If as the CMO of Alpha Sites, with my designers, we design a great visual identity, but it doesn't make it through to the piece of recruitment collateral of the website, then I failed and my team failed, right? So it's all in the implementation and it's all in the impact. So to your point, advisors need to help you get to that end goal. Just handing off a beautiful presentation, that's the start of the journey, not the end.
Yet if you go and look at any case study from any of the brand consultancies, it'll be, well, this is the start and this was the end. There's very little that you see in those stories about, well, okay, the work is beautiful and I love it, but did any stakeholder, what actually happened? But how does that connect and translate into impact? So the last question sort of on this transition, you were talking about your mandate where you've got internal comms and talent marketing. Does that mandate change over time? Like, do you have your eyes on the next thing as well as part of this, as part of the evolution of your role and the maturity of marketing and how brand is perceived inside Alpha Sites?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And one of the things that I've been focusing a lot on over the last sort of 12 to 18 months is the collaboration between marketing and the product team. Again, within the context of Alpha Sites and the fact that we are a tech-enabled company and our goal is to get our users onto this digital platform, it's incredibly important for our two teams to work more and more together. And so what that translates into is, for example, on the email marketing side, the beginning of my journey was, okay, let's set in place rigor and structure and metrics. Okay, now let's bring in a CRM and a marketing automation tool. Okay, now let's build workflows into that sort of very typical process. And now after having run through that playbook, the next step is, okay, now how do we get more and more of our users to go from I click on an email to I go to our platform, and then we continue to engage with them on the platform as opposed to in their inbox, right? So that's just one example, but other examples are user journeys where people go from our website to our platform environment as well. So I think one of the things that's changed for me as a marketer is really pushing in that direction of how can I collaborate better with the product and engineering team? How can we think about the end goal of user engagement being on the platform and marketing changing strategies and messages in order to do that? And also, it has a huge impact on our MarTech stack as well and how we think about using it in the future and what additional functionalities we then ask our tech team to build into our in-house tech stack. So I'd say that's probably been the biggest shift in my mandate and my focus.
And how do you get feedback in turn? Like, how do you know how well you and the team is performing on delivering the objectives? Like, I was talking to the CMO who, when she came in, she actually implemented an internal NPS score, which was interesting. Like, I'd never heard that before around with the marketing team, with other business leaders. We could probably do a whole another session just on that, on the pros and cons of that. But curious to like, how do you know sort of how you're being perceived and how you're doing as a team?
I love the idea of the NPS score. It didn't do that. But so half of my team is very focused on client marketing, and that is eminently trackable. And we can link it back to certain client activities and revenue generation. So quite honestly, the numbers tell us if we're performing well, and when the numbers are good, then the sales team love us. And when the numbers aren't good, they like us a little less, right? So that part is a little bit more black and white, easier to get a temperature check. The other half of the team, which is focused on topics that are a little bit squishier, talent marketing, internal comms, external comms, design, et cetera, it is harder to get a real-time pulse of how our work is going down. For every person on the marketing team, we run sort of evaluations every 6 months where we ask stakeholders for feedback. That is generally very helpful because, number one, it creates a feedback culture where you're signaling to the business, we want you to tell us how we're doing. So it kind of creates that habit. And then very often, even though you're asking for feedback on an individual, what you'll get back is sometimes feedback on the department, right? Or on me. And so that's another way that I've been getting it. And And that way you can get it from lots of different levels, lots of different geographies, right? And then of course, just sort of one-on-ones and catch-ups with people that are kind of in roughly in my peer group or perhaps one level down, that and just asking them how they're viewing the work and what they would do differently and what they thought of how they were asked to collaborate, you know, that sort of thing. At least at AlphaSites, people, when asked, are very willing to provide feedback. So it's just about asking for it all the time, really.
How do you ensure you have that on the right cadence with the number of people? Do you keep it on a spreadsheet? Is it set times like monthly or 3 months on the calendar with different people?
Yes, it's basically every 6 months after joining, right? So they join and then after 6 months, they're sort of, and we decided on 6 months because that way, you know, you have probation or integration and then you kind of move into a natural cycle. And essentially everybody's manager is responsible for running those surveys. So therefore I then don't have to be in total control of it all, right? I just set that cadence and then everybody does it for their direct reports.
All right. So let's end with just a quick fire round. As you think about your role, as you think about just marketing today, right? Being in a CMO, what gets you most excited?
I love working with people that are super passionate about what they do and who enjoy like the process of doing the work a lot. And that's what gets them fired up. I think that's what gets me most excited.
And what about frustrated?
I get very frustrated when the vision or the brief is unclear.
I think we need to do a whole episode on better briefs. Yeah, there's a brilliant study that was done that Mark Ritson, who's a professor and writes a column for Marketing Week in the UK, has been touting a lot this survey that was done with agencies and marketing leads around the quality of briefs and how that's his biggest bugbear right now.
I totally understand. I just think that, and I get it, it's very hard to know what you want. It's incredibly difficult, right? But I think that a lot of marketing teams struggle because someone goes to them and says, I want A. And so you start to develop A and then you come back with A and they're like, no, I don't want that, right? And so you end up in these iterative processes, which waste a lot of time, they waste a lot of money. And then also they can be incredibly frustrating for all the stakeholders involved and create almost like a vibe where people think they're not collaborating properly, where people think they're not doing their jobs properly, right? So, and I think it all comes down from the fact that a lot of individuals haven't thought enough about what they're asking for at the beginning. And they haven't understood that it's okay to spend 2 weeks, if that's what it takes, co-creating a really good brief, and that will save a lot of time further down the road. So yeah, that's definitely one of my bugbears as well.
When you think about your team, when you think about talent, and this is like advice for sort of younger people as well, what's your view on generalists versus specialists within the marketing function overall?
I think it's really important to become a well-rounded marketer before you specialize. I would encourage any young person who's interested in marketing to try to collect a variety of different experiences in the first sort of 8 to 10 years of their career. I just think it gives you a lot more insight. It gives you more longevity in your career as well. There's some people on my team, and I love the confidence when I ask them, you know, what do you want to do later? What's your aspiration? And they're like, I want your job. I want to be a CMO. I'm like, okay, great. Well, then if you want to do that, you're going to have to collect a bunch of experiences, right? You can't just do one thing. You need to get well-rounded.
You think that's a bit of a challenge today? Like with the rise of digital, you start to see there's too many people who then say, oh no, I'm just a digital marketer and I do this. And even this idea of, no, there isn't a digital marketer. It's just marketing. Because you're a marketer and you need to understand digital.
I would agree with you. You're a marketer and you just need to understand digital, and you're a marketer and you just need to understand design, and you need to understand brand. And it's the exact same logic. And there will probably be limitations to how deep you can go in your knowledge in any of these disciplines. I've worked with graphic designers my entire career. I still can't design anything by myself, right? I don't know how to use InDesign, but I know how to work with designers well. I have an eye for design, right? And I think if people look at marketing with that lens of you need to learn about all of those areas. And yes, of course, it's incredibly useful if you pick one or two and you go super deep and you become a deep expert, but it's not realistic to become a deep expert in all of them.
How do you stay fresh and current?
I listen to a lot of podcasts. I read books, magazines. I talk to a lot of friends and colleagues and things like that. So that's sort of how I stay fresh and current. I think one of my favorite ways is just to actually talk to people who are non-marketers about things that I see. So asking friends who are bankers and asking my kids about what they thought of Mattel's marketing of the Barbie movie, right? That's, I think, my favorite way to stay fresh and current, because then you're just getting sort of a more unfiltered perspective that I find helps me think, versus reading 20 articles in industry rags that are probably all going to say roughly the same thing anyways.
You mentioned books and podcasts, and I'm going to ask you maybe for a recommendation of a book or podcast that you've listened to and read in the last that you've really enjoyed.
Yeah, I've been reading the book about the founding of Nike. Sorry, I need to look it up.
That's okay. I can never remember names of books, even ones I might be reading right now.
Yeah, so I haven't finished it. And actually, I say reading it, I've been listening to it. I do the audiobooks thing. Hold on. It's going to bug me. Shoe Dog. I highly recommend Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. It's about Nike. Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. And then in terms of podcasts, I listen to ones that are not necessarily about marketing, like Diary of a CEO or Pivot, or, you know, just they're not necessarily about marketing. Sometimes you'll have an episode related to the topic. Like everyone, I like to listen to podcasts where I think the hosts do a good job.
All right. So the big final question then is, what did you think of the Barbie movie?
I thought it was very good. I really enjoyed it. I went to see it with my two kids. So I have an 11-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old boy. And my favorite part of the experience was that in one part in the movie, America Ferrera gives this long monologue about how difficult it is to be a girl or a woman. And after watching the movie, I asked my kids about it. And my 13-year-old boy, who, granted, lives in London, you know, he has a very sheltered life, right? He said, you know what? It's just as difficult to be a boy, right? I don't understand why she's going on about how hard it is to be a girl, because all the things she said are true for me as a 13-year-old boy as well. And I thought that was really interesting. And it gave me a lot of insight into what boys in his experience, right? So very sheltered London life, the pressures that they're experiencing. And it added another dimension for me to the movie as well, which was a little bit less gendered and more about just a generation and the pressures that a generation are feeling.
Maybe at the end of the movie, they do end up recognizing it. It's just not as explicit in that beautiful monologue that she had, but in the whole notion of that he is Knuff, that we are all Knuff.
Yeah, you're right. They did recognize it. I did enjoy it. I did like Oppenheimer more, though.
I still have to see that one. Why did you like it more?
I mean, Christopher Nolan is a wonderful director, and it's just absolutely beautiful. His use of sound in the movie and just the cinematography, it's more artistic, it's more sophisticated visually. It's a completely different style. You really can't compare the two, but it's a style that I really like.
Well, Gabriella, we'll end it there. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a really insightful and interesting conversation. The time flew by.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.